You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
And we are back with an all-new Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm unmasked, Louis Fertel. Will the world re-embrace me? Who knows?
And joining us...
Oh, I guess we'll formally introduce her? Sure.
Yeah.
Guys, hello. Grace Parra here co-hosting today. I am so excited. It is a delight to see you guys again. A delight to be here.
I know. When did we last have you here?
It's like 2 years ago. And it was she was just explaining the wild coincidence between the two guests we've had while she was co-hosting.
Yes. Yeah, so last time I co-hosted was with Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend. And of course, today's episode features Rostam, also from Vampire Weekend. So there is some sort of brujeria going on. That I did not know I put out into the world, but we're keeping the Vampire Weekend and Grace Parra, that bond is strong forever, I think.
It's also an eventful episode because I do interview Rostam this week, and he was the first guest on Keep It.
I love it.
So,
is it Gemini season? I feel like that has something to do with where we are right now.
It is Gemini season. It is Gemini season, and I am a Gemini rising.
Ira, there you go.
Yeah.
No, wait, what? I'm sorry I'm about to ask this, but what does that actually mean?
Okay, so like your rising sign depends on like the time you were born.
Oh, right. Okay. So I don't know that I ever actually found out what time I was born, so I think I'm just every sign.
You're every sign.
Including stop.
Were you had in like a barn and then your mother woke up days later? I'm sure she knows what time she had you.
Well, my mom weirdly has no long-term memory for stuff. She's like a with it cool person, but if you ask her what happened anytime, she'll be like, I just don't know, Louis. I'm not like you. So like it's like a resentful thing to have to ask her about old stuff because she thinks I'm like trivia Louis, and she thinks I'm expecting her to be that way, and I'm not, Mom. I'm sorry.
And unfortunately, Louis had a long-lost brother who returned and burned all of the documents regarding Louis's birth to take his place, but it didn't work.
Exactly, it didn't work. But he's still out there somewhere, so...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he knows what time you were born, Louis.
Yes, but he's the only one who knows.
Yeah.
I'm not that curious, so you can keep that, yeah. It's not like a Don Draper, Dick Whitman situation. There's nothing to find out from this person.
Well, this is going to be a exciting, so to say, episode regarding some of the topics. We are finally going all the way in on the Kardashians. Mm. So,
which means I will have to come up with something to say about them, which we'll see if I do it.
If you hate them, I'm sorry, Keep It listeners. But also, I think it's time.
And I think it's time.
Yeah, you know, they're done, allegedly. Not really. But their long-running show on E! Is over. So we are finally going to talk about the family that has eluded conversation on Keep It for so long, except for when the rapper who married into the family decided he wanted to run for president. Right. Couldn't ignore that.
God, we did our best to avoid that. We really tried, but...
Yeah.
And then also, In the Heights is out... in theaters and causing a commotion.
Not that big of one, though. Disappointing opening weekend, but yeah.
I know, which we have to get into, by the way. Latino Twitter has been going off. We have been energized. It's a colorful time in the Latinx community right now, for sure.
Ooh.
Okay, well, Grace is here to tell us all...
She seems turnt.
Yeah.
I am.
She's going to tell us all about Eva Longoria's angry tweet thread. There's probably not one, but there could be. She's always talking.
She is.
So, we'll be right back. This Pride Month, Love It or Leave It host John Lovett returns to the stage for an exclusive Pride performance called out of the closets into the streets. On June 24th, join John Lovett and a lineup of your favorite LGBTQ plus acts, mostly the stars of Keep It, but other people too, as they bring the celebration right to you. Out of the Closets, Into the Streets will be streamed live on June 24th at 4 p.m. Pacific Time. Join the fun on Crooked Media's YouTube page and Twitch pages. Out of the Closets, Into the Streets sounds like a Bruce Springsteen song about him coming out. After 20 seasons and 14 years, a gubernatorial recall, a self-made billionaire, a Pepsi commercial, a Parisian robbery, and an internet broken many, many times over, we are finally, at long last,
done with Riverdale. Oh, no, Kardashian. Yeah. Damn it. Yeah.
Baby, we will never be done with Riverdale, okay? Not as long as Veronica and her father are feuding and Archie is...
A redhead?
Yeah, a redhead. I don't know.
I would call it like a red-orange head.
Yeah.
It's very circusy, yeah.
Oddly enough, many of my dating profile bios say I'm always watching Riverdale because I am a big Riverdale fan, but... It's kind of a lie because I have not seen the last season and a half of Riverdale.
Wait, you're lying on a dating profile? Nobody does that.
The first time this has ever occurred. Yeah.
But no, we are finally at long last caught up with the Kardashians. Mm.
Doesn't it feel like when Melissa McCarthy ended her run on like Mike and Molly or something though? Like, oh, was that still going on?
Who even knew?
Yeah, aren't you already, you know, ensconced in the real superstar universe? It's like this was the thing they did to formally remain an entertainment presence, even though they've expanded into this strange, nebulous, omnipresent thing that isn't entertaining or unentertaining, you know?
I have never seen an episode of Keeping Up the Kardashians with the Kardashians, Keeping Up the Kardashians. I don't know what the title is. I think there's an extra preposition there. So I've never seen a full episode of it, and yet I feel like I know everything about their lives. So I don't know if that's because the television show was effective or because they've been really, really good at doing the whole social media thing. But I don't think any of us are going to miss the show. I mean, even fans, right?
Yeah, I have friends who watch it, and they're not obsessives. I have never met one of the Keeping Up with the Kardashian obsessives in my life, and I am frankly very grateful for that because they seem scary.
Yes.
I've met Bravo fans, IRL, and they are terrifying. So if you're like an E! Super fan, where's my gun?
But by the way, that it's so interesting that you bring up Real Housewives because I feel like even though the Kardashians, I think, are likely to be lumped in with Real Housewives just in terms of the type of entertainment, Real Housewives is like chock full of events.
Entertainment.
As in, you can't get through like the episodes connect to one another and you need one to get to the other. There's so much going on. Whereas on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, I feel like they get to like, they buy like a t-shirt every three episodes, just like, or a bikini top or something. It's really slow.
I just feel like it's Courtney whining about not having enough ice in her iced coffee every episode for like a full 20 minutes.
It feels very similar to sort of the first reality show, An American Family from 1973.
Mm, the Loud family.
Yes. Yeah, it was followed the California family, right? You know, mm-hmm. because... It is not Real Housewives. Real Housewives is reality TV that is more modeled after soap operas. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the drama, there's new characters, like Lewis said, you know, like there's cliffhangers leading into each episode. I mean, this season of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills is the first one where each episode is literally ended with "to be continued." Mm-hmm. Because the drama between the housewife and the hustler is hot. But Kardashians, I've seen clips before, and the clips you've seen before, if you have not watched full episodes, are usually more entertaining than a regular episode that you would watch. Like, if you've seen the clips of, like, Kim and Khloe fighting, you know, or, like, Courtney and, like, Scott Disick arguing about something, or even any clip with Kanye, it is more entertaining than the entire sum of what you will be watching, because I tuned in for the final episode, the two-part, and wow, it is like pulling up the Calm app on your phone, okay?
I was just going to say that in some ways it sort of reminds me like the Truman Show, if Truman knew, was totally complicit in being watched 24/7, that there's something maybe pleasant about it just being on in the background. It's a great show to fall asleep to have on, like in the way that my parents watch CNN on mute a lot of the time. I feel like that's what keeping up with the Kardashians, I'm never going to get that right, keeping up with the Kardashians is for a lot of people. I mean, 20 seasons worth of that. Yeah, there's not a lot of action. So I feel like it's just kind of nice background noise.
I also feel like that show existed like seconds before things like Instagram stories did. And they sort of set the tone for that universe of quote unquote entertainment, which is nothing's really going on. I am going to do it in front of you unashamedly. This isn't going to key up into something dramatic that you'll even remember 3 minutes from now. But it is something to pass the time. It's like passing the time is the goal of the whole thing.
It was the series finale, and you have scenes where Scott and Courtney are sitting on the couch scrolling through their phones. This is the height of drama on this show. You know, it is very soothing. I found it comfortable to watch, you know, and I was like, oh, if I had been a fan of this, and like reruns were on the same way I watch reruns of other reality shows that I enjoy, I definitely would have seen all the episodes multiple times, because if there's a marathon on, I probably would have just hit play and then done so much with my life while it's playing. It felt very comfortable even then sitting into it. And what's so interesting too is the way they discuss news that we already know about them. You know, they're discussing like the divorce with Kanye, and you're seeing, you know, Kim talking about it with her sisters, and it's, you know, this interesting thing where they kept saying, Kim is a very private person, but, you know, if she's not even talking about this with her sisters, this must really be hard for her to be going through. And I'm like, there's no part of me that believes that she's not talking about this with her family when the cameras aren't rolling, you know?
Of course.
But the presentation of it is so interesting. You know, it's things we already know, basically. But you're watching the family go through it, which, again, happens on Housewives, you know? But I feel like on Housewives, even when you know something has happened, you're still waiting for that drama, or there's like a little funny moment or character thing that you haven't seen yet. Like Jen Shah being arrested on Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, when that airs, will reveal so much to us that we didn't see, right? And you'll also see a woman trying to change her public image in real time while being filmed. But this is very casual, relaxed. It's, they already have control of their image, so there's not even a lot of, you know, let's get ahead of this Kanye story happening on the show, because they've already gotten ahead of it.
Yeah, there's no like urgency to sort of fight for relevance. They just sort of exist in it and know it's not going to go away. My question was, do you have any particular favorite interactions between Kardashians and pop culture? Because I can think of one that I guess speaks to what I sort of think of them. And that is, do you remember the live 30 Rock where Tina Fey, they did a New York version, or the East Coast version and a West Coast version.
Yes.
And the surprise guest star in the opening seconds on the East Coast version was Paul McCartney. So he comes in and people are just like, you know, like tears are shooting perpendicularly out of their face. They can't believe Paul McCartney's there. And then they do the West Coast version, and that same cameo slot is filled with Kim Kardashian, which I think was an in-joke from Tina Fey being like, fuck you, West Coast. You know? That's the superstar slot you get, you like loser cads.
That's amazing.
Didn't they get rid of one of them when they put the episodes on streaming?
One of the live ones, right? I don't
Potentially,
know.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, ooh.
I would assume it's the Kim Kardashian one, but I have no idea.
My favorite interaction, Kardashian interaction of that ilk, is actually more of like a maybe overarching societal interaction, which is that to me, the Kardashians taught me, you know, there's that great meme that I have to repeat here, which is that you're not ugly, you're just poor. And I feel like we've been able to see that evolution happen on their show and through their social media, that really you can just buy whatever kind of beauty you want. And that gives me comfort. It gives me a little bit of comfort to know that every month, if Chloe can present a new face, that maybe I can too. And in those moments where I'm feeling like I have low self-esteem and, you know, I'm not a natch beaut, that it's not me. It's really just that I don't have enough money to be where I want to be yet. And I feel like that's a lasting legacy of the show that I think is going to stick with me going forward. And I really, truly mean that there is something comforting because it's like, you know, sometimes and we've all talked about this in multiple occasions, but you scroll through social media and you feel like there's just these images of beauty that you can never uphold. But I feel like there's a transparency that the Kardashians have presented us with about how they achieve their beauty. And it makes me aware of the fact that it's not natural for a lot of people. And that's okay. You can still be hot. You just got to buy it.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, like, look, if you come into $900 million, like, look, a certain subset of your problems do go away.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, absolutely.
That is charming.
Yeah. I like to give people accessible beauty on Instagram.
Yes, not me.
Mm-hmm. I full want like trapezoid angles in my face. I want to look like pyramidal prisms, etc. Just
I will commend you, Lewis, for no longer taking selfies in horrible lighting that look like Hitchcock was on set.
That is something that continues to baffle me about Instagram is that people are good photographers. I don't get it. It's not a skill I have. And like people like the Kardashians for elevating square photography as an art form. I mean, that's their medium, right?
Yeah.
They're like the Richard Avedon of that, right? So good for them. I have not acquired that skill, but Godspeed.
I do want to hit on the fact that despite avoiding talking about the Kardashians on this show for, you know, the almost 4 years that we've had it, we have talked about them because they're sort of impossible to pull out of culture at this point, and they've created and affected so many things. I mean, the amount of conversations that we've had about cultural appropriation over the years just because of Kim, you know, taking on, you know, black beauty standards and sort of making them palatable for white women has been a big conversation that got even bigger, you know, as the Kardashians became more famous. I mean, obviously, she is a actress and personality in her own right, but I think that Jameela Jamil as a conversation topic is directly related to her deciding to take on the Kardashians.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, I see.
The first nuggets of people really talking about her online, you know, and pushing her into the stratosphere as sort of, you know, an activist was, I'm going to take down the Kardashians and what they represent, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, also, the Kardashians are just the easiest target in terms of pundits having something to talk about. Like, you can always be like the hero if you are, I don't know about denigrating them, but talking about how you don't get where they're coming from or whatever, even though that became so cliched immediately. That's a problem I have with the Kardashians is like every conversation about them has already been had and people keep reiterating it like they're the first one to think of it. That to me has been a lasting problem over the past decade.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that has something to do with the fact that every single one of them in their own right has some sort of individual name brand? Because I thought that was actually like, I sound like a Kardashian stan today. Maybe that is the that's something
that's
I didn't know.
That's my takeaway from this. Yeah.
But there is something. Yes.
Let's rank their brands.
As name brands,
as recognizable ones, as ones who post this, you know, because we do know that they're developing a show for Hulu, and we don't know if it's going to be one show, we don't know if it's going to be multiple content things, but going forward with what they've set up, ranking who is going to be most successful going forward, and who do we think is the best at what they're doing?
Okay, I got to start with the OG Kim. I mean, I think she is why everything started. She has the biggest following on social media. She's the most ubiquitous. She has the cutest kids. Not just amongst the Kardashian clan, but I think amongst all clans around the world. She and Kanye really, really know how to create adorable children.
The best narrative. I mean,
the best narrative.
People keep bringing up the sex tape all the time, and then they also used to always bring up all her divorces, but now she has a new one, too. Kanye West and kids with him. So for better or worse, he will always be involved in her life. Mm-hmm. So that is a narrative going forward that really none of the other ones have aside from Courtney and Scott Disick.
Right. I got to go next. I would say Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think
definitely. I think you're correct.
Yeah, she's the matriarch figure. And my thought is that going forward, I'd like to see more of a presence from her personally, something that's maybe separate from the institution of the family. I don't know what that looks like necessarily, mm-hmm. but something that's all hers and all her own. I think Kylie is next for me because she's got that. I think I might be wearing a Kylie lip liner right now. Oh, God, guys, I'm a Kardashian fan. I didn't even wow. realize that until this
Grace.
Podcast.
Did they hire you? Did they hire you for that? Yeah. Kylie's brand has that whole X Factor quotient of how did it get this big? It'd be one yeah. thing if she were like pretty successful, but it's like you've launched way, way, way far ahead. You know, it just like yeah. it feels like it happened by too many lengths.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, yes, yes. And also her daughter is adorable and I like Travis Scott a lot. So I really, and I think that they're still together, which makes me happy.
Yeah, we keep seeing photos of them together. So I think that they are. And, you know, I did briefly get a glimpse of her when I profiled Travis Scott for the Face magazine.
Oh my God,
year.
I love that article, by the way. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Amazing,
thank you.
Ira. Yes.
Kylie also, I feel like, is the one who gets to be the ballsiest, like Kim, because I feel like Courtney and Khloe are sort of always attached to Kim as their sister, and they were always tasked with do something publicly when Kim is going through a crisis. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure Courtney and Travis Barker do like one another, mm-hmm. but I don't think she'd be sitting in his lap at Nobu and Catch LA every night if Kim weren't going through a divorce.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, 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 yes.
Whereas Kylie really took the reins and was like, well, I don't have to do all that shit because I'm the younger sister, you know, and Kendall's off being a model. So she's like, I'm going to be the one that, like, the internet also is mad at as much as they're mad at Kim, as long as I get the results of fame and power.
Yes, yes, which she has, I mean, in spades.
Yeah, she would be my favorite character if it were a soap opera.
Yeah.
You know, if these weren't real people, I would be like, oh, well, I love this bitch. She's the scammer.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Kendall, though, she's on the bottom of my list. I would say my next three are in a totally different tier. That's those three are the tier one, mm-hmm. tier two for me has got to be Khloe, Courtney, and Kendall mm-hmm. at the very bottom there because the Pepsi thing, sorry, not awful.
Legendarily bad, yes.
Legendarily yeah. bad. The tequila thing. I mean, I know we're about to get into Latino Twitter within the heights in a second here, but that really set people. I am not okay with that.
Here's
my
question about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I obviously know pretty much the answer to this, but I'm devil's advocating here because it is a podcast and I want to explain it to people because we haven't talked about it on the show. See what I'm doing here? I'm breaking the fourth wall just like they did
just
in the
like
finale.
Oh yeah, Fleabag here.
But
yeah.
Explain the big difference in Kendall's tequila drama as opposed to, say, George Clooney starting Casamigos. Because I feel like a lot of celebrities have liquor brands, but Kendall's tequila one is specifically designed to do what George Clooney did with partnering with a tequila company and then selling it for a shit ton of money. I feel like every celebrity starting a brand now
yep.
isn't really even doing it because they love liquor. It's uh-huh. I need to keep this going for a few years to get enough of a name recognition to then just sell it.
Mm-hmm. Well, frankly, what George Clooney did with Casamigos, though I believe it's a better tequila, objectively.
Oh, it's great. I haven't had Kendall's, though.
I haven't had Kendall's. I would not. But I actually think that George Clooney is just as complicit. I think that he has not gotten enough slack for this. And I think that it's unfortunate that he hasn't. And Randy Gerber, too, is in the mix there. But I think that we were very forgiving because it's George Clooney and George Clooney can kind of do whatever he wants. And I think that, you know, this might be a little bit of sexism happening in the media that, you know, Kendall has gotten a lot of flack for the whole tequila thing. I think that it's deserved, but I think it would have been deserved with George Clooney, too. And it's interesting now that the Casamigos brand has sort of superseded even George Clooney's involvement with it. So we don't not everybody necessarily knows that there's a correlation. But I feel like most people, especially like Gen Z types who would be drinking the 818 tequila that Kendall is behind, know that she's behind it. So there's an awareness level there that can't be extracted from your consumption of it. But also, to be fair, George Clooney didn't wear, like, you know, long braids and put on a sombrero and wear, like, you know, denim in the desert, which is something that Kendall definitely did when she was trying to sell the brand. So she was putting it
so
on.
So Gen Z hasn't seen From Dusk Till Dawn is what you're saying.
No, but the second they do, they will understand the correlation. Yeah, I think Kendall just laid it on so thick, and it was so obvious. You know, and I think even the branding of it just makes it, the tequila bottle itself looks like it wants to be portrayed as by Mexicans from Mexico, and that's just not the case at all. Well, as I think Casamigos was oddly a little bit more elegant about that. So ultimately, not too different, I would say, but I am glad that we're having that conversation, because I really do think that, you know, tequila is one of those from Mexico artifacts that we should really, you know, buy tequila, but buy brands that are made from Latin American purveyors. That's my takeaway.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like as I've gotten into Mezcal more, I've gotten more into
smoky.
Recognizing brands, recognizing the region they're coming from.
Yep.
And it's like doing even that basic education to learn flavors and notes and like what is actually good. And I think I actually will try Kendall's tequila just so I can have an opinion on it.
I want to hear your thoughts. Yes.
I'll tell you all about it.
Yes.
When I'm having my reduced fat Wheat Thins, if they're not from a sheaf in Kansas, I will throw them right out. I want to know the patch they are from. If they're from Aida's part of the country, Nebraska, that's not what I want. I'm talking
here
about
she
us.
Goes.
Yeah.
Here she goes. This Wheat Thins brand, you are really working hard for what you're after.
Honey, you want a cracker that's just got a little bit of that sweet in it? You got to get to the reduced fat Wheat Thins community. They will reach out to you.
Well, I think those rankings are good. Her at the bottom is great because, you know, Kendall, she's a pretty girl, but she's a flop.
Yeah, I agree. What else is there? What else is there besides the face? I need more. And what I've seen is tequila and Pepsi, and that's not the more that I want.
Doesn't even taste good together. Have you had a tequila Pepsi before?
Oh, I don't like thinking about it.
No.
Yes, a vile concoction. Anyway, we're officially caught up with the Kardashians.
For
and
good.
I doubt we will ever have to discuss them again.
No, meanwhile, they're like Slugworth and Willy Wonka. They show up wherever you fucking go.
Whispering in our ears.
Yeah. Caitlin's still running for governor. Governor.
Oh, God.
All right, when we're back, I am going to reunite with Keep It's first guest, Rostam. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of black stories, black truths.
Black perspectives have always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts.
Our guest today holds the esteemed honor of being Keep It's first ever guest.
Wow.
Truly, first ever guest, second episode, and he is thrice Grammy nominated, a singer, a songwriter, a producer whose new album, Change Phobia, is out now. Hi, Rostam.
Hi, Ira. It's good to be here. Good to be back in the Keep It hot seat.
I'm gonna like rewind to January 2018, which I feel like I don't even know if I interviewed you then, because I feel like I banked that interview before the show actually debuted, but it ended up being in the second episode, and you were our first guest, and you were just coming off of your first album then.
Yeah, I remember getting an email from someone on my team that was like, do you want to do this new podcast? And you could be the first guest on it. And I was like, what's it about? And then I was like, okay, yeah, I do. I want to be on it.
Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you agreed to come back. But, you know I love you. So I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And I'm glad to talk about this album, which is fantastic.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like whenever I tell people I enjoy things, people are always like, ugh, that means so much coming from you. And I feel like that is a sideways way of saying that they think I hate a lot of things. But I don't. I actually feel like I love a lot of things, but I love this album mostly.
I know that you love some Beatles albums that I think are trash, but...
Did we talk about the Beatles before?
We have. I think you and I have very different tastes in Beatles.
What's your favorite Beatles album?
I will say I like all of them except for Abbey Road.
Okay. That's a choice.
And when I say all of them, I mean like all of them starting at Rubber Soul.
Okay. I think my favorite's Revolver.
I thought you once told me your favorite Beatles album was like something like really early. Like,
okay, I said my favorite Beatles song is You're Gonna Lose That Girl.
Okay.
I didn't say that. I didn't say I like the entire album. I think that's on Help.
I actually do like that song, so maybe I'm tripping when I try to come at you for your taste in the Beatles.
See, like, also Help is a very good album. It's got Ticket to Ride on it. It's got I've Just Seen a Face. It's got Yesterday. Okay, it's got like three good songs on it. It is not actually a good album.
The Beatles album is tricky because they are responsible for albums that are good front to back, which I feel like so people are capable of giving you an album that you can just listen to all the way through.
That is very true. I have gotten a new vinyl record player for my house now. And the last time I had one was when I lived in New York. And setting it up and then deciding like which albums I want to play on vinyl, it has been very distressing to go back to playing like a Mariah album that I like, or like this Strokes album, and being like, I definitely want to get up and skip this song, but it's much harder to do when it's vinyl. So you got to just let it play.
That's something I thought about a lot when I was making this album.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I want to make an album that people can listen to all the way through. And I think part of the reason that I got there was because there were multiple people that hit me up on Instagram. They were like, I love Half-Light. I listen to it every day, like all the way through. And that kind of scared me in some ways, because I was just like, you don't even know what Half-Light really sounds like if you listen to it all the way through. You were too scared to like actually listen to it all the way through. That's my confession, that it was really hard to listen to it all the way through. I spent a lot of time listening to how one song flowed into the next.
Mm-hmm.
But on this album, I was like, you got to get over that. And so I got to the point where I was like actually able to make multiple versions of it and listen to the whole 38 minutes. And I did start to move around songs like to make the order as good as it could possibly be.
So are you a person who can't listen to his own music back?
No, I think I can. I mean, I think you have to. But I do think there's also like, there's this quote from Julian Casablancas in an interview that he gave where he was like, finishing a song requires listening to it so many times that you can maybe never listen to it again.
Mm.
And I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I mean, I have read many interviews with actors. I mean, interviewed actors, too, where they talk about they can't watch themselves back. But that's at least different than, you know, a musician, because, like, you film something and then it's done. And it's not even to the level of, like, if you're, like, a theater actor, because I guess you're never seeing yourself. But, yeah, it must be hard to work on an album, listen to it constantly, finish it, and then... What do you do when it's time to like tour and you got to play those songs again constantly?
Well, I think what kind of starts to happen is like there's a part of your brain that has like a, you know, the critical component. And when you're listening, you're like trying to decide if something is good enough mm-hmm. to release. Then there's another side when you're listening to your own music where it's like hitting certain pleasure receptors mm-hmm. in your brain. It's like, and I think that's why those of us that make music, like that's why we do it. It's because we like to hear this music that hasn't existed before that we're responsible for. We actually just, and on some level, you just like, you like the way it feels mm-hmm. when you hear this music you made. But something does happen after listening to it hundreds of times where like it stops having any kind of emotional resonance or emotional charge. So you don't really feel moved by your own music at some point.
Mm. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, that's so interesting to hear, especially because I feel like music as like an artistic medium is the one thing where it's like, it is about moving you, right? You know, because it's like there are specific albums that I can't even tell you whether they're good or not, but it's like it's an album that I listen to because it is tied to like such a specific moment in time when you first listen to it. And then it's that emotion sort of always comes back when you're listening to that song, you know? And it's hard then to then be like, oh, yeah, I think this album is good, or I think this certain song is good because it's so attached to specific moments in time.
I definitely feel that. I've definitely felt that with records. I seem to like get obsessed with like maybe like one album every year and just want to listen to that all the time. Like last year, it was Christine and the Queens EP.
Mm, that's a great EP.
Yeah.
My friend Royce got me into Christine. It was on like a drive home from a warehouse party in LA, and he was playing it. And then like as I was hearing it in the car, I was like, wait, I really like this. And now whenever I listen to Christine and the Queens, I always think of the car.
You're back in that same seat that you were sitting in, mm-hmm. coming back from the warehouse party. It transported you.
That's interesting. Like you say you get obsessed with like one album a year mostly. But like how much music do you listen to? Because I feel like I listen to so much music in so many different genres that it's hard for me to like, it'd be hard for me to be like obsessed with an album throughout the entire year. Because I'm like, you listen to it constantly and then something else is out and I got to listen to it. You know, I think I'm already done listening to Sour.
Wow.
But I listen to it constantly for like 3 weeks.
Has there anything that's stuck with you for longer than 3 weeks?
I think the things that stick with me, because I'm constantly moving to a new album that's coming out, I think what sticks with me longer are older albums. And they don't even have to be like from when I was growing up, right? It can be like, because I think that the way music comes out so fast now, and like I'm a pop person too, so like I'm always listening to like new pop music or new pop album. There could be like a new album I really like and say it comes out last summer and then I move on to other music the rest of the year. At a certain point,
then you come back.
It'll come back and I'm like, cool, now I listen to this album in a regular rotation.
Okay, here's a question for you. When you listen to albums, do you listen to them in album order?
It depends. There are specific artists where I'll like put the album on when it first drops and like listen to it all the way through. But I will actually admit that I do not do that for most music. I will play it and I will skip to the songs that hit me immediately.
What?
And then I will sort of go back and then like, so part of it too is like I'll rediscover like songs that like I used to skip sometimes. And I'm like, oh, I really love this song. So I feel like I'm an erratic listener when an album comes out.
I remember when I was a teenager and like kind of getting into album listening with CDs, The Bends by Radiohead was a big CD mm-hmm. for me as a kid. And I remember like the first song that I loved from it was High and Dry. And it was like, all I wanted to do was listen to High and Dry, put in the CD and just go straight to High and Dry. But then there's this thing that happens. It's like when you listen to it like five or six times, at some point, you just like allow the next song to come on, mm-hmm. and then you kind of get into that song. I don't know. Did that happen to you too?
Yeah, I feel like that's a thing that always happened to me. With like, there was always the one song that I kept hitting back on, and I feel like that happens now, right? Because it's sometimes if you like forget to hit repeat on something or put it on like the button that makes it replay, right? If you go back to an old album and you like play this one song and then you're like, oh, I did not realize how much I loved that song. I brought up like the Strokes earlier, right? And I loved the song Selfless on the new Abnormal. And then I had never listened really to the next song, Brooklyn Bridge, to chorus, until one time it played after. And I was like, oh, this is a good song too.
It happens.
But I am a person who sticks with one song. And unfortunately, because of like, because of the way things stream now, and it's so easy to make like playlists, I'll sort of like, once I listen to an album like a couple times through, I'll just take the songs out that I like and put them in a playlist of songs that I like for the year. So I'm constantly listening to those and I forget about the other songs.
Yeah. And then, but I'm sure something happens where like, if you realize like how much you love those songs, then you go back and you're like, wait, is there more on this album that I could like go deeper on?
Yeah.
Does that happen?
It does. No, I mean, I feel like I'm constantly discovering songs that I didn't really listen to or skipped over from albums that came out in like high school and college.
So yeah, High and Dry is track 3 on the Bends, and Fake Plastic Trees is track 4.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure that was like the second song that I got into, Fake Plastic Trees, and then Bones, and then Nice Dream. And then I was just, at that point, maybe like after you like 4 songs on an album, maybe you can like the whole album.
That's true. Although a lot of my favorite albums that I still would call perfect, sort of like I get to that last song and I'm like, I don't want to hear this.
Oh, interesting.
Recently, one of my favorite pop albums of last year did that. Miss Dua Lipa.
Wait, I actually like that song.
You like Boys Will Be Boys?
I do.
And Girls Will Be Women?
I do like that song.
It sounds so like Brave New Girl, Britney Spears. I'm like, it feels like it doesn't belong on the album.
I think for me, I just have such, like, if I'm going to listen to pop, I'm not going to listen to it with that kind of critical ear usually.
That's fair.
Well, that's actually not true. I'm probably really critical sometimes, but occasionally I do think, when something is like really good ear candy, I'm kind of there for it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a side of my brain that just I love ear candy. And to me, that Dua Lipa song is giving you that ear candy.
Yeah. I mean, like I've always been like an ear candy person. I mean, I feel like the pandemic is when I discovered that I like hyperpop. So that's been a whole thing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Somebody thought that I had a hyperpop moment on my album, but it wasn't intentional.
Which song? I mean, Interlude really goes in.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, this is like, maybe Rostam wants to make a hip hop album.
I mean, I feel like all the albums that I've been a part of hopefully have good sounding drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like the first step to good hip hop is the drums. So I'm always thinking about how drums should sound. Should they sound real? Should they sound fake?
Mm-hmm.
So on some of them, I'm always like thinking about hip hop when I'm producing music. It's always on my mind. So,
I mean, speaking of hyperpop in general and just like pop music, I feel like you're friends with so many people who make that kind of music, but you don't make that kind of music. Do you think that you would have fun making like a really poppy album, or is it just like not for you? Because I feel like you're like because like you make the Haim album, like Claro, you know, but you're not giving us like Jack Antonoff.
I feel like for me, maybe the music that I make is so much about the people that I make it with.
Mm-hmm.
And someone actually asked me something recently about like, would you ever make like a pure pop album? And my answer was like, if I found the right person who wanted to make pure pop, and we really had a strong connection, then yes, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, I think you can expect that from me before I die.
Okay.
I just need to find the right person to do it with. I want to make an album that's pure pop, but I guess on the other side of it, like it has to mean something.
Absolutely.
I think it is just about finding that right person, and then maybe it'll all unlock and I'll give you the like sugar rush that you've been waiting for.
So what is your favorite pure pop album that is equivalent to the Bends in your mind?
That's a great question. I thought Bangers was a great pure pop album.
Bangers is a great fucking album.
It's a great album.
It is. I was revisiting it recently, and I was like, why did I like not listen to like 4x4 more?
That's a great song.
Perfect. And very underrated Britney song.
And in addition, I saw the Bangers tour twice.
Oh, wow.
And I have to say it was one of the best live performances that I've ever seen.
Okay. I love that.
It was incredible. It was an incredible show.
Okay.
If you saw it, you know what I'm talking about. I'm guessing you didn't see it.
I didn't see the Bangers tour. I enjoy Miley, but I don't think I've ever seen her in tour.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky both times that, you know, I had like a friend of a friend who invited me last minute. It wasn't premeditated, but it was just so fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like that. I like thinking of Rostam making a Bangers at some point.
Yeah, maybe I got to do it with Miley. maybe that's the key.
Maybe that is. I think that would work. I think she'd make an album with something to say.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah. I mean, I think she always has a little something to say. So
sometimes too much, but I feel like she and I have that in common. So I can't judge her for it.
I don't want to walk this road with you, Ira.
Lastly, I just want to ask you, what feels so different about this album as opposed to the last one for you? Like, are you happy and settled in as like solo Rostam? Like, are you vibing on this new path?
I guess your question is maybe like, yeah, there's things to answer there. Like, I do think I spent like 7 or 8 years making my first album and picking up that album and putting it down. And I was also in Vampire Weekend at the time. I was part of another band, but making this album, it was like, yes, I truly was on my own. And musically, I kind of wanted to do something that felt like a departure from all the music that I'd made. So on this record, I was like, do you really want people to know you for harpsichords and classical music? Like, is that your signature, or do you have more to say musically? Mm-hmm. And that was what I asked myself on this record. Like, that's what I wanted to kind of say, like, hey, that's not me. I'm not just that classical person. I'm also capable of doing things that have nothing to do with classical music. So that was kind of where I landed and what motivated me.
Okay. Well, you know what? I love your After Amadeus moment. It's a really good album. And I'm not just saying that because we're friends. Like, I really like this album.
Thank you, Ira.
Yeah, and I actually enjoy it better than the last one. Not to pit two bad bitches against each other, but, you know, Change Phobia, I really enjoy.
I hope that you enjoy it. I hope you enjoy the next one even more. Then I would know that I was really doing my job.
Okay.
Just trying to continuously make better and better albums. But I actually haven't listened to my first album in a really long time.
Hmm.
I'm thinking about it. Like, I want to set a date maybe like a year from now. It'd be kind of fun to listen to that again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are you going to listen to it before you start touring? Or are you just going to like play them from memory?
That's interesting. I think it's a different thing, though, when you're listening to something with an objective or if you're just kind of listening to it to enjoy it.
That's fair. Okay.
A little different.
Cool. Well, I will now forever bother you about when I'm going to hear your bangers. So you have that to look forward to.
Cool.
And thank you for being here. Thank you for returning.
The return. I'm so grateful to be back. Back in the hot seat.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, the adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's first musical, In the Heights, hit theaters and HBO Max to critical acclaim and low turnout. But it was good. I didn't mean for my voice to go up like that. Like I'm pretending I liked it. It was good. I enjoyed In the Heights.
I did not.
You did not.
I mean, we'll get into it. Everything John M. Chu did, like the choreography looked great. The immersiveness of the world was well realized, I thought. Mm-hmm. But I thought every character had the same personality. I thought everybody was like a little bit plucky and a little bit sad and gonna make it work. And it was like there was no distinguishing between their ambitions and all of their storylines were equally minute.
Yeah.
Like the stakes felt low to me.
Except for Abuela.
Except for Abuela, who, by the way,
take your medicine! Take your medicine, bitch!
I watched on HBO Max. I should have gone to see it in theaters, but I actually sat down on Thursday because I thought the first 8 minutes were available, and I was like, oh, I'll just watch the first 8 minutes. But I guess the whole movie was available, so I ended up watching the whole thing at home. I had to fast forward through the Abuela stuff because, oh my God, I mean, give me an old person in a movie, and I lose it. Coco, sorry, lost it.
Oh, yeah.
Up! Ugh! Up! I cried so much during that movie that the people who were sitting next to me got up and moved.
Wow.
Well, it's just old people in general doing basically anything. You
yes,
need to,
yes.
You need to not see Cocoon. You need to not see Cocoon.
Can't see Cocoon. Can't do it.
Okay. I feel like I really enjoyed it because I had, you know, still the muscle memory of seeing it on Broadway.
Oh, okay. Oh, you went and saw a Broadway show? I'm blown away that you went and got to the theater. You don't bring it up. It's crazy. Go ahead.
Well, as you know, I did go to the Parsons School of Design.
Oh, okay. That's your new brag? Yeah.
Famously a Parsons student. No, I saw it on Broadway more than once because I entered the lottery a bunch of times.
Mm.
So it was enjoyable to watch. Although I will say that there's a lot you could cut from In the Heights.
Oh, yeah.
Because Lewis is right in sort of the depiction of the characters and also just long. You know, there's chunks of the movie where I'm like, what are we doing here? I will say the framing device was cute until the end. Did not like the way that the film was framed because I feel like it's basic lying to the audience. You know, you have Usnavi telling a story and it seems like, you know, he left New York City, you know, it's like he's on the beach and then you realize at the end that he's not on the beach. He's like imagining he was on the beach. And I think that is inappropriate and rude in storytelling.
I believe I was misled as well in that regard. And I feel like the simple solution is just put him on the beach and they're there on vacation. You know, he moved.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he realized that home is home and he never wants to move permanently. I found it really hard to be objective about the movie. I don't know whether I liked it or didn't like it because as a Latina in media, I was just so thrilled that it existed.
And totally.
That it existed and the drama that has kind of ensued in the last few days has been so interesting to witness.
Mm-hmm. That's how I felt with Soul Plane. Just so happy it existed. I still can't criticize it. Just
talented, like, Mr. Ripley here. Oh my God. White people looking so shiny, which we need.
We just need that. But yeah, I really enjoyed watching it, but I was so, and I have been so nervous and anxious about how it's going to be portrayed in the media and how it's going to be received by people because, and this is the unfortunate element of the fact that there's only one big Latin blockbuster that happens every few years. This has to mean everything to all Latin American consumers, which is so frustrating because it ends up having to be everything to all of us, even though we are not a monolith and it's going to be impossible to service every, you know, insular facet of Latin American representation. But it becomes this thing that everybody wants to succeed so badly that we're more concerned about how it's being received than what we actually think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, like, there's this no debate about there not being enough Afro-Cuban representation in the movie, correct?
Yeah, Afro-Latinx, yeah, representation in the movie. Mm-hmm.
It is called In the Heights, and it is set in the Washington Heights, and I did live in the Washington Heights, and the movie is a little light for what the Washington Heights was, okay?
Yeah. It's a really valid criticism, and I'm glad that we're having that conversation because colorism is a thing in the Latinx community. And I don't think that it was malicious, but I just think that it shows an oversight in the kinds of faces that we traditionally see when it comes to Latinx representation on camera. And yeah, I mean, the fact that it's about Washington Heights, which is a community that is very diverse in terms of, you know, the faces of colors that we see, I think that it missed the mark on that. But though that is a valid issue, I also think that the problem is that there's only one in the Heights. And if there were many, you know, if there are other projects that we could turn to, if there were other films that we knew totally. Were coming out, mm-hmm. then we don't have to place all of our hopes and dreams on this one film. But because there are so few, there's just so much that we require in order to be satisfied by a movie that's created by and led by a Latinx cast. And it's really frustrating. And to me, the bigger concern is this going to signal to the gatekeepers of the entertainment industry that Latino communities are not worth taking a chance on or are too fragmented to try to portray? And my belief is that is very cowardly. My hope is that this actually signals to people that there's a big, passionate, and growing and burgeoning Latino community that wants to consume, and we want to see projects that represent what we look like. So now is the time to double down on that audience and to greenlight a billion different projects, because clearly there's a hunger for it and an audience. That mm-hmm. I think is a pivotal point that we're at, that I'm hopeful to see. But you know, to the point that that's been brought up a couple times now, the fact that the box office was not great for the movie in the first week is a little scary.
Yeah,
mind you, though, I mean, it's such a bizarre time to go back to the movies, period. Like,
yes.
I went and saw it in a movie theater, and I don't even remember the last movie I saw. Like, maybe Bombshell a year and a half ago. Not a good movie to go out on. Bad choice, Lewis. But I mean, I just read today that like 34% of vaccinated people feel nervous about behaving normally in society. So because we're in this gray area zone, I feel like people shouldn't read too far into this didn't get the box office results we necessarily wanted, even though A Quiet Place 2 has done mysteriously well.
Yeah.
Not that it's not well reviewed or anything, but I got my eye on that movie. How did that happen? Anyway.
Well, I mean, you know, people do love that jingoistic American cracker. Okay, you want to talk about Kylie Jenner ratcheting up to a level of fame so quickly. I know that this man was on The Office, but the way that John Krasinski has like whipped up white Americans into standing him so hard, it should be examined.
Right.
Is it just because he's Jack Ryan and, you know, white Americans love, you know, military people shooting people in the face? Like, is that what it is?
I have no idea. It's those approachable cheeks. I mean, that's what's going on. Right?
I think so.
He is attractive.
It might have been the switch from Jim to Jack Ryan. It's the fact that we saw him evolve into a hot action hero, I guess.
The Chris Pratt model, yes.
I am not ashamed to say, you know? I'd fuck John Krasinski on an American flag.
Okay, well, not a question that was posed, so interesting that you had a response to it.
But an answer we needed. An answer we needed.
But by the way, I want to say about In the Heights that, to me, the triumph of it is a excellent spotlight role for Daphne Rubin Vega, who we still mainly know as the original Mimi from Rent.
Right.
And it's this name that lingers in pop culture, but we don't see a lot of her. And she really, to me, not only has a lot of personality in the movie, or has the main personality in the movie, because the other ones feel pretty static to me. Mm-hmm. She gets the best song, which is in the salon about the gossip. To me, that's the funniest part of the movie, too.
Yeah, I agree.
That scene and that song is iconic. And also, 95,000 was a highlight in the stage show, and it's definitely the highlight in the film. The dance
sequence.
Lotto
ticket sequence, Love it. By the way, as somebody who loves scratchers, and I think I just mentioned that I was in Texas visiting my family a couple weeks ago, I went ham on some scratchers.
I love a scratcher. I love lotto tickets.
I do too.
Definitely always used to get them at the corner store in Milwaukee, got them at the bodega in New York, and recently I was on a cross-country trip in the South, and like every gas station we stopped at, I always had to get a scratch off. So,
but doesn't it? I know this is a sidebar, but doesn't it feel strange and foreign to get scratchers here in California? For me, it does. I don't do it here. It's only when I'm home. It's only when I'm in the Midwest. I can't do it in California.
I do it sometimes when I'm buying like gas, or I'm getting like a Red Bull before my night out. But it does. Mm. It isn't in my immediate sort of like senses to get one here.
Yeah.
I was really engrossed once upon a time with the McDonald's Monopoly game, which was a sort of democratized version of Scratchers for children could understand. Mm-hmm. The idea that I could leave McDonald's with a new Sea-Doo, I don't know, that really spoke to me. I think I'm very influenced by The Price is Right, so the prizes aspect really thrilled me.
Yes. Oh, I was going to say one thing about In the Heights, another element that I was thinking along the lines of the conversation about representation. I feel like we're overlooking the fact that the representation of an undocumented character in this movie is really brilliant. I mean, I thought it was a character who had some funny moments, who wasn't just like stressing out about his documentation status during the course of the movie, which is a rarity. I feel like most often when we, with the exception of Nico Santos on Superstore, who I think is a triumph, generally when we see undocumented characters are just, you know, enshrouded with this fear of like being found out, and that's their entire storyline. And I thought that In the Heights represented an undocumented character who got to have a little more depth. And that was great. So in the conversation about representation, I think it's important to bring up the elements, you know, whether it's Daphne Ruben Vega, who we haven't seen in a while, whether it's an undocumented character, Anthony Ramos, who's somebody who, you know, the film has now broken in a way that I'm so excited to see what he does next. I thought he was brilliant in this movie.
He is fantastic. He's fantastic. I'm remiss that I have not seen In Treatment this season,
right. Yeah,
because I hear that his episode with Uzo is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
But I'm already stressed out talking to my own therapist. I've never been a fan of the original In Treatment because it's stressful TV.
I do think the original In Treatment is like underrated prestige television because it's television that exists to spotlight guest characters in really awesome ways. Like I remember Mia Wasikowska on that show. That was the episode where I saw, oh, you're going to be a huge star, and I'm still wondering what the fuck happened. I guess we did give her Alice in Wonderland, but but Diane Wiest, obviously brilliant. Yeah.
Of course.
Alice in Wonderland launched so many careers.
It's just like Tim Burton has made a career now for like 25 years of making things you already thought he made. Like he's working on the Addams Family now. It's like you didn't do that before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at Alice in Wonderland, you don't have like a comic book about Alice in Wonderland out in the world.
I think I was talking to maybe my barber or someone else about this because I have a Batman tattoo that I got after Prince died. And it has the Prince logo by it too. And it's to signify that my favorite Prince album is the Batman album. And that also I love that film. And he was like, oh, I love that film. Love Batman Returns. I was like, yes. And he was like, are you a Tim Burton fan? And I said, I don't know.
No, you know? Yeah, right.
Because he is even wilder than most directors, you know, who have sort of like an off film and then a great film. Like he's truly hasn't had even a film that I care to rewatch since Big Fish.
Ooh.
Right. I think he's also just somebody who it's so not just aesthetic driven, but a specific aesthetic. And once you've had enough of it, you don't need more of it.
Mm-hmm.
So he keeps delivering that, generally speaking. And like there are like Ed Wood is underrated in certain ways. Yeah. I would say it's like a better version of The Disaster Artist if you've ever seen that movie.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
It's an easy thing to be over, especially when it's out of vogue, because he was very in vogue for a while. Anyway, I'm sorry to do this to our conversation, but anyway, yes.
No. In fact, if I could just add one thing, the thing that I do want more of from Tim Burton is more about his relationship with Helena Bonham Carter, because that's a household I need to know about.
Right, yeah.
Whatever that was, I just need to know what was going on there.
Right.
Yeah, whatever he was drawing upon in his earlier stories that made, you know, like the Batman movie was so great that made Edward Scissorhands so beautiful. I need that again. I feel like he's definitely on autopilot with, you know, giving you an aesthetic and giving you that feel that he used to deliver. But maybe he needs to go personal again, because I also think we don't know much about Tim Burton as a person.
Right. Which is interesting.
But maybe Helena does.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Helena, one of the great interviewees, by the way, if you're ever bored. I'm somebody who does this a lot recently. Maybe this is something I picked up in the pandemic and my YouTube just knows me. But just watch one person's interviews, like, for an hour straight. I'm very obsessed with the cast of the Mary Tyler Moore Show right now. But Helena Bonham Carter, brilliant interviewee when she does interviews, which I usually see in print, but look her up. She's great. Lisa Kudrow, fabulous interview. You could spend all day listening to her.
Yes, I love it. I love that.
But I also wanted to add that Anthony Ramos is my second favorite performance in the movie. He really does carry it with a sense of not just relatability, but his drive does feel real. What he wants feels the realest part of the movie, I think.
I think that's totally fair. And I also think that, like, you know, box office be damned, when it comes to movie musicals, people will continue to discover them indefinitely. And I think that, you know, In the Heights is going to be one of those movies that people will discover for decades to come. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a worthwhile investment. I think it's a beautiful watch. I think it's fun as hell. But I also admit that I think I might not be the most objective viewer, because I also want it to do well and I want it to be so good. So I'm just more invested in it than I think I am with most movies, because again, we don't get that many movies in this ilk for us, for Latin Americans. So,
well, if you are disappointed in the representation of In the Heights, do not worry, because West Side Story is coming out very soon.
What a crazy year for the Golden Globes not to exist, because we actually have a competitive musical slate this year.
That's so right. Oh, you know? My God. Oh, that's a disappointment.
If I'm not mistaken, we haven't had a Best Picture category at the Oscars with two musicals in it since the year Oliver won, which is 1968. So,
What was it up against?
Oliver was up against, of course, Funny Girl, which is an iconic movie that is also unbelievably long. Oh, my God. Unforgivably long. And Omar Sharif, a B-minus as an actor, gorgeous. Also, A-plus facial hair.
A-plus creator of Hot Gay Sons, though.
Oh, yes.
Omar Grandsons. Sharif Jr.?
Grandsons,
Is his grandson?
That's correct, yes.
Wow. He is hot. And he used to follow me on Twitter.
Well,
you remember, I'm banned.
Oh, right. You have the ban. I forgot about the ban.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to think that my tweets had more Latinx representation than In the Heights.
Like to think an important verbiage there.
All right. Before I get canceled, when we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. I always love doing this. It's so much fun. And Grace, you're back. So we're going to let you go first.
I'm back, baby. I'm back with a hot one. Get ready. Buckle up.
Ooh.
Strap in. Get on your goggles. I don't know why you'd need goggles for this.
You're like a maniacal roller coaster operator or something.
I mean, she's giving us Margot Channing right now.
Yes,
I am.
It's going to be a
bumpy
night.
Day, evening, and night.
A whole damn week.
A whole damn week. All right, so I'm curious what you guys think about this. My keep it is to any events that begin at or after 8 p.m. I can't do it.
Ooh,
I can't
really?
Do it. I wish I could. Wish I had it in me. I don't have the stamina anymore. I'm exhausted. I like to go to sleep early. My body tells me when it's time to call it for the day. And it's, you know, 9 o'clock at night. So for events that start at 8 or 8:30 or 10 p.m., I can't hang. I can't do it. It's tough for me. I might be alone here. I know I'm missing out on a whole world of experiences that happens when the sun goes down, because 8 o'clock is, by the way, still sunlight hours here in Los Angeles during the summer. So I understand that I might be a weird anomaly, but I gotta say, guys, it's real tough for me to stay up past 10 p.m. these days.
Okay, two questions for you. One,
yes.
If you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
36.
36. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, here's my second question.
Yes.
Are you aware how Ira conducts his weekends? Specifically, this past fucking weekend?
See, in many ways, I feel like I can live vicariously through Ira, so I don't actually have to live it myself. I can...
Okay, that's going to work out for you in the health department, because...
Okay, first of all, I will not have this onus thrown just on me. Lewis and I are famously gay men who live in Los Angeles, so we go to events that start at... 12:30 a.m.
Sure, whatever. Now, I will say, Grace, I'm waning a little bit. I do really enjoy sleep, and I like being active early in my weekend days. So I am, my participation in a 5 a.m. event is waning a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I feel like there's a hunger among gay men to keep the deep part of the night a part of your life specifically. I don't know what it is. Like, I think there's also specific FOMO to gay culture where... you just want to be where the action is, because so much of our lives are sort of like, you know, just mixing with normals. And so you want to be with the abnormals in a real serious way.
Mm-hmm.
But Ira is really burning the midnight oil and the 6 a.m. oil. So,
oh,
well, you know what? Call me Corona, because I love the rhythm of the night. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Call you Al DeBarge. Yeah.
But to sort of agree with that, because I am getting older, and you know, the hangovers do come, and you know, I do just sort of sleep during the day. It helps that I'm a screenwriter and don't keep like regular daytime hours as well. If I worked a 9-to-5, I would not be able to have the life that I lead. But I will say that I do prefer a day party.
Me too.
You know? And so, like, I love, like, a long day party. Lewis and I were at a lovely day party this past weekend, and I feel like a day party is fun because then you've had the fun during the day. You're enjoying the sun. You know, like, you can still see, like, people's face. The person that you're talking to, you still, you know that they're attractive because it's the middle of the day. You know? Like,
there's
night. It's not night. You know, there's not, like, different lighting, you're not figuring things out. So I do enjoy a day party because then that ends and you're sort of at home, like watching a TV show, getting high, and then going to bed. I enjoy that. And as opposed to parties and things that start at 9 or 10, you know what I do love? I do love a late dinner, like a European. Give me a 9 o'clock dinner reservation and I am there.
I will say something about late night events that I don't like is, like, obviously when we're talking about the stuff Ira and I go to, like, the socializing goes away and it becomes like an unce thing, which is fine. And like, look, I love being lizard brained and just like zoning out with a bunch of dudes, whatever. But I'm really ignited by talking, like verbalness really gets me going. And so
verbal elation.
There
verbal
we are.
Elation.
Yes. And I prefer, and you get so much of that at a daytime party. So.
Now, here's a question about a 9 p.m. dinner. Is that the event, or is the 9 p.m. dinner the segue into the rest of the night?
It can be both, but I feel like whenever I'm traveling with friends, too, and you're trying to get like into a restaurant, it's easier to get a later reservation.
Sure.
Or if you're just like, you know, like a... in Paris or like London or something, it's like you're doing things during the day, or especially if you're a person who enjoys theater, right? You're always going to have dinner afterwards because, you know, when I'm visiting New York and seeing a show, it's like, friends like, oh, do you want to have dinner? I'm like, are you free at 10:30 p.m.? when I get out of this four-hour-long play. so yeah, I do love a late dinner. And sometimes it's even more beautiful when it's just like, that's the end of the evening, because then you're sitting there and you're having conversation over drinks, and then the restaurant closes, and then you head home.
I think I need to start. I think this is just, you know, pandemic era also talking, that I've gotten so accustomed to, you know, being asleep at a certain time every night. So I got to spread those wings, guys. I got to let nocturnal grace fly.
Just like once a month. It doesn't have to be super.
Just like once a month. Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Let's go to a late night dinner, Grace.
Yes.
Have some Kendall Jenner tequila.
Yes. I'm so in.
Lewis, what is your keep it?
My keep it is slightly uninformed, so I'm going to apologize for it ahead of time because I haven't read this book yet. But as I have expressed previously on this podcast, Sinead O'Connor is just one of my all-time favorite artists. She's somebody who's known for a couple of scandals, obviously the Pope ripping situation on SNL. She turned down a Grammy early in her career.
She killed Natalie Wood.
That's, which is crazy. She would have been like 13 years old. But she's such a distinct and only could be Irish in the way that she is both garrulous and soulful. In the way that she is both spiritual and seemingly completely atheistic in certain ways. But she has a new book, a memoir, and it's, I'm so glad we're hearing her story from her own mouth, because she's somebody who I think is just maligned in even what are supposed to be objective stories about her. She's somebody whose story is always told in a strange way. But my keep it this week specifically is to, we have just let Prince off the hook over the past few years, I think, generally speaking. I think, and in this book, there's a story about a kind of horrific night she has with Prince where he chases her, hits her with stuff, and you think about it, and she obviously had a very abusive childhood. I think hardcore Prince fans have already had to grapple with the weirdness of Prince, and like, he had a protege that he sort of became the legal guardian of, and then married her for a while, and there's lots of and there's a story about another protege, Vanity, he like threw in a pool once, and we haven't really put it all together, because I think ultimately, we are enamored of the mystery of Prince and how he kind of lived his life off the grid, and we'll never really know what happened. And there are a few like firsthand anecdotes of dealing with Prince, really, so you can sort of keep your distance in a way that we used to with Michael Jackson, because we didn't really have lots of firsthand information about him for a while. And I think maybe it's just time to think something was really the fucking matter with this person, specifically how he treated women. And I think that's something, it was easy to fool ourselves too, because he always had like female musicians with him. He loved gender bending. He seemed to not be freaked out by associations with femininity. So
Until later in his life too.
Oh, you know, right.
Where he was vocal about, you know, like being associated with like queer culture.
Yeah. And then hating things like swear words, which he also rails against Sinead O'Connor about anyway. Go ahead, Grace.
Do you think that he would be, were he alive today, would he be facing some, you know, court of public opinion consequences in the vein of being canceled or whatever?
I think that's probably true. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think these stories would add up in a serious way. Because when you look at them back to back, it's just gross. Like the composite picture is apparent and disgusting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also just how we used to allow musicians at that time, male musicians, to behave. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not just him. It's not just Michael Jackson. You know, it's John Lennon. You know, it's like many rock stars. You know, I think it was just sort of the norm that bad behavior outbursts were acceptable. Mm-hmm. And people weren't called out on them.
And sort of in a weird way, like wrapped in with what is genius about them or what is strange about them. You know, it's part of the mythology ultimately.
Whatever allows him to do his thing, he should just continue to be able to do, is sort of the perception that we had. Now we understand, you know, just because you're a great artist doesn't mean that you can get away with whatever the fuck you want.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that we're evolving towards a place where, you know, we have an understanding that great artists do not get a free pass to just act however they want.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're Roman Polanski, I will love him till the day I die.
Oh, okay. Okay. What a crazy ride or die choice to pick one.
It really is. Wow.
Could you imagine?
Yeah.
I love Ghost Rider so much.
Oh, yeah. The Pianist, honey. My number one. Yeah.
I watch it over and over again. Just a feel-good movie.
Yeah. Ira, what is your keep it?
My keep it this week goes to Chrissy Teigen.
Mm. Oof. This is a long conversation. Here we go. We'll try to condense it. All right.
Buckle up, guys. Hope you're still buckled up for my keep it.
Right. Well, if they follow instructions, they will be. Yeah.
Yeah. As you know, Chrissy Teigen has experienced a lot of quote-unquote soft cancellations recently. I think the first one of recent note really came when she and Kris Jenner announced that they were going to start a line of household cleaning supplies. Because I think that, you know, the cult of Chrissy really sort of enjoyed her as a funny, brassy, you know, like joke teller on the internet who also would sometimes critique other celebrities and be mean to them, right? Mm-hmm. And then they loved the cookbooks and her relationship with John. But I think once like household cleaning supplies got added to the mix, it was like, oh, you just want money, and this isn't really about, you know, like your brand and things you care about, you know, because like I have the cookbooks here, and I think they're actually pretty good, and you like the personal stories in them. I don't know what personal story I'm gonna get from the Windex that you made, you know, and so that I think started sort of breaking the dam of, you know, the veneer she created, and it brought up a lot of the criticisms that, you know, Black women had of her in the past, particularly, you know, when she called Kavenzine Walls cocky.
Who was like 11 years old at the time or something.
Yeah, you know, better than what The Onion did, but still, you know, kind of wild. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there was the resurfacing of tweets that she wrote about Courtney Stodden when Courtney Stodden was like 16 and married to that creepy man who was in Lost.
Right. Mm-hmm. what a specific 2009 phenomenon that whole thing was. Anyway.
Yeah.
And he was 52 at the time, I believe. I don't remember his name, and I don't need to look it up, but yeah, old.
Creepy old man.
Yeah,
that's his legal name. Actually, he had it changed when he became an actor. Uh-huh. But the tweets were, you know, a lot of tweets like calling her awful, telling her she should kill herself, and then there are also DMs that she sent to her, saying the same thing and even worse. And now people are sort of like, okay, that was bullying. And let's have that conversation. And Chrissy has apologized a couple times for it. And I would say that the apologies are very insufficient. I've read them, like, on her blog. I don't think any apology has ever named Courtney by name.
No. Mm.
You know?
Well, also, she's also being called up for saying things to multiple people, like jokes about Lindsay Lohan, in which she said...
telling her to slit her wrists.
Yeah. Well, here's my response to that. I'm not saying that's an unawful thing to say, but also, I feel like people are a little bit naive about how horrible comedy about celebrities was like 10,
right.
15 years ago. Because if you heard that joke on a celebrity roast, you would not think twice about it. It sounds like a Jeffrey Ross joke or a Lisa Lampanelli joke to me or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. So there's an entire reckoning that still needs to take place about how we talked about a certain class of, generally speaking, female celebrities around mm-hmm. that time.
We started doing it with Britney, you know.
Yep,
with
and Paris Hilton, too.
Yeah, yeah. Revisiting mm-hmm. the monologues that were even said mm-hmm. about these women. But there are countless jokes about every female celebrity mm-hmm. of that ilk from that time that not just famous comedians did, that mm-hmm. regular people on the internet tweeted all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And continue to tweet, to be honest.
Man, it just it takes a lot of time to harass this many people online. And to do so over the course of so many years, so consistently, that's what was striking to me. And even in her apologies, she just can't stay away from the internet. And I mean, look, a lot of us are addicted to it. I understand. And I know that, you know, as Ira, you rightly mentioned, she gets, you know, she has all these sponsorships. She gets money from her interactions with people on social media. So I understand that there's, you know, that element that she's considering. But I just feel like Chrissy Teigen has enough resources to be able to say bye to the internet, to go to the Swiss Alps, to raise her kids for 10 years, come back and write the tell-all and not fuck with any of this. And the fact that she can't go more than like 3 weeks without sending some sort of an apology via the same mediums that she used to harass other people, to me seems like there's an addictive quality that goes beyond even just the money. It's sort of like an addiction to the attention of it all, or an addiction to the ability to connect with so many people and to have her voice out there, which you know is one of the pratfalls of having pitfalls of having you know these mediums where we can connect with people so easily. I think the apologies just seem really transparent, and it all just seems like it's in an attempt to preserve those sponsorships for money. And I also understand if part of that is preserving the jobs of the people with whom she works. You know, if she said, like, listen, I've got a staff that I want to make sure they're taken care of, and if I don't do my due diligence and make sure that I'm right with the world, then they can't work. But none of that is ever made transparent. So it seems really icky, and it seems kind of capitalistic.
It's definitely that addiction, you know, because I recall her leaving Twitter.
Yes, yes.
You know,
multiple
and then coming
times.
Back, mm-hmm. and a lot of people do that, and then like announcing it publicly too is also seeking attention. You
yes.
know, and I'm there with her. Because I felt like, you know, like Twitter was sort of like this push and pull for me where like some of it was fun, but some of it felt gross and I really wanted to be off. I was able to come up with a very fun way to get myself suspended from the website and the decision was made for me, you know. But when she was making her own decision, she came back. And I think to really dissect this, it is, you remember how she first gained her attention on Twitter? It was... live tweeting while she was on an airplane, you know, and like people got used to like, oh, this model is also funny, you know, mm-hmm. and I think she then craved the attention of telling jokes and getting people to laugh at her and find her funny. And then at some point, you know, she was transitioning into a different sort of brand, you know, as I talked about that a bit with T.S. Madison when she was on the show, but, you know, like how she first started with her Vine vids, which were a bit cruel and sexually explicit. Then she realized kids were watching and she was like, I want, you know, sort of a different brand. And I think Chrissy did really try to shift her brand, but
yeah.
it's unfortunate that her brand before was, like you said, like a concerted effort to harass a lot of people. And it's even more unfortunate that she can't really seem to get out a good apology, especially considering what she's gone through. Because, listen, I've been in John and Chrissy's home before for a political event, and they've been on Potsy of America before. And so I've met them backstage, and very lovely woman in person. But to talk about the history of her attacking people online, you also think about the one of the reasons she said she left Twitter, right, was because people kept writing mean comments to her in her mentions. And it's like, are you missing the disconnect here? Chrissy and I have DM'd before, and she DM'd me once to apologize to me because she responded to a tweet of mine, and that was during the era when she was part of the Pizzagate, right? QAnon people that she was like, you know, like pedophile. Killing children, the pedophile ring. And she responded to me saying, I'm so sorry that I pulled these people into your mentions. The attacks are relentless. Like, it's so hard to be on the internet every day with these people constantly in my mentions. And I'm like, what is the part of her that does not see the connection there? You know?
Well, also, in her apology, something I wish she had gotten into more, because she does say explicitly, I was a troll, which, all right, I just want someone to explain to me, then why do you become a troll? Like, what was the satisfaction in doing it? Because to me, I still don't understand the worst of the behavior. I understand she apologized for it, but I'm kind of like...
That was beyond trolling.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You
like,
know?
Like, take me step by step towards, how did it come to this point, having to say this statement. I'm sure we'll be getting that in the future too. Yeah.
Because we've all trolled on the internet. Grace Parra, thank you so much for being here. It was an absolute delight to have you on, as always.
Of course. We knew it would be.
Yeah.
You guys are amazing. I am the biggest fan. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We'll see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Caroline Reston, and Brian Semmel is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. I think I've heard of him. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week. Stay safe. Be blessed. God loves you.
Ashley's Memorial Day sale is going on now. Shop our biggest selection of hot buys, cool deals, or shop limited-time savings on new summer spaces. Plus, get 72-month special financing on select in-store mattress purchases made with your Ashley Advantage Synchrony credit card between May 14th and June 3rd. Whether you're redecorating indoors or rethinking your outdoor space, save big on this season's trending styles. Only at Ashley. Subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. No minimum purchase required. See store for details.